Okay, so welcome to yet another talk at this retreat center. And yesterday I was talking a little bit about insight and how it helps in the meditation, and that when we do get any blockages whatsoever in meditation, in other words, it's not getting more and more peaceful, more and more free, there has to be something there which we are doing which is blocking it. So I do remember this time when two of the very famous monks in the tradition which I follow in Thailand, it was an Ajahn Mun and an Ajahn Mahabua. And these two monks, Ajahn Mahabua was staying with Ajahn Mun, and Ajahn Mahabua had this fever. It was malaria, because many times that was what happened. If you stay in the jungles in those days, you're going to get malaria sooner or later. And all the forest monks had it. And so this monk Ajahn Mahabua was really tough and fierce and strong. And he was the one, I was saying to the monks the other day, that he had a heart attack one night. And that in the morning they brought a Chinese doctor to see him. And the Chinese doctor felt his pulses, which apparently, I was told, are only four pulses they can feel. But other people say more than that, so I don't know who to believe. But anyway, every one of his pulses showed that he was dead. But he was still alive. And the Chinese doctor couldn't believe it. And so, but you know, he's obviously talking to him, so he must be alive. So because of that, gave him some medicines and just stuff. So he survived quite a few more years. But the reason was that he was such a tough monk. So some of these monks I saw are just, wow, I mean, they just really, they were fathers in their past life, in their early life rather, really tough. And they could just, amazing just what they could endure. You know, I remember another monk, whenever he had a fever, he would just get the saline drip, buy it in a shop, and he put it in his own hand, his own arm. You know, just, and didn't ask anyone to do that, just did it himself. There was another, oh, so this is a gross story. There's another monk, he was a good friend. The guys would think this is a very funny story, but he was actually stupid. Because he decided when he was urinating, that he's always urinating at an angle, so he decided to circumcise himself. It's absolutely stupid. It was crazy. And he did that late at night, and the blood didn't stop. So he had to go to hospital, and they get stitched up, and he was so embarrassed. And the head monk in this little monastery, he never let him forget it. The head monk had no compassion at all, but was saying, oh, look at this stupid monk, he just circumcised, almost killed himself. But those sort of monks, that's how sort of tough they were. And, whew. So anyway, that it was almost in their genes, they were the real tough people. So what happened with Ajahn Mahabua, when he had a fever, as studying under Ajahn Mahabua, it came to the time for the work. He wasn't going to see a doctor. He wasn't going to not join in the work. So he went down from his hut. He was sweating and shaking, picked up a broom and started sweeping. His willpower overcoming the sickness of a malaria fever. And Ajahn Mahabua saw him. So Ajahn Mun saw his disciple Ajahn Mahabua. And he blasted him. He said, that is not the way of a Buddhist monk. A Buddhist monk doesn't fight. A Buddhist monk doesn't try and overcome things. The Buddhist monk just relaxes and understands things, contemplates things, gets to know them. So get up to your room and lay down. And that was, Ajahn Mahabua told me that personally. Because I came to his monastery, he didn't know I could understand Thai really well at that time. So he gave the talk in Thai, and at that point I really remembered, I thought, wow. sort of it's Ajahn Mahabodh, who was known to be a tough guy, a tough monk, was telling me and everybody else that is not the way of a Buddhist monk. And then he told one of the translators, translate that for the visiting monk, which was pointing at me. But he didn't need to translate, I'd already understood it. So, whenever we have any problems in our life, in our meditation, whatever, we don't keep pushing through. Because if you push through, if you bang your head against the wall, you just get a headache. There's a time when we understand to let go. Another similar simile was of the villager from Bung Wai who was taking his water buffalo out to graze. And as he was taking his water buffalo out to graze, past Wat Nanachart Monastery, as he was taking him out there, the water buffalo saw something which made the water buffalo scared. And you always know, we taught this as young monks, when the water buffalo is placid, it's just so calm, kids can just go to sleep on its back and just all day, and the water buffalo just graze. But this particular time, if the water buffalo lifts its head up, that's the sign that it's scared of something. And I don't know why it was always supposed to be scared of monks, because I thought maybe it was because that the monks in the distance looked like same color as tigers. I think that's probably one of the reasons. But anyway, at this particular time, the water buffalo saw something, was scared, and tried to run off. And the farmer had the water buffalo held with a string, and more like a little rope. And the farmer tried to stop the water buffalo. Now, in a tug of war, who is stronger, a water buffalo or a farmer? It's no contest, is it? So what happened? The string wound around the top of this man's finger and pulled the top of his finger off. And we saw that because he came into the monastery just before the alms round with half his finger missing and just blood all over him. And I think maybe because the shock, the adrenaline or whatever, it went into his body. He wasn't so screaming in agony. He was just holding his finger and just looking. It's really weird. So we took him to the hospital and got him stitched up. But afterwards we used that as a story. That why are you fighting things which you can't defeat? He could have just let the water buffalo go. And if the water buffalo let it go, the water buffalo only runs 100 meters down the road. And if it feels safe. And then you just walk slowly after it. And take the cord again, you can lead it to the field. No problem, that way you keep your finger. And the same way that sometimes our mind becomes like that. Our mind becomes crazy, has defilements, doesn't want to behave, and for one reason or another wants to run off. And what do? You try and hold it back with the power of your will. And what happens? You lose a couple of fingers. What is it hurts? Oh. So, there is a time when we learn how to, the power of letting go. Just let it go, it'll be okay, you can go after it afterwards. Or, one of my stories where I learned about the inside of letting go, not fighting, but understanding. Wisdom power, not willpower. And that was a time, I told it so many times, I'm not embarrassed about saying it, but you know, it's young monk. I was only maybe about 28, 29 at this time. Had this beautiful monastery up in the mountains above Chiang Mai. And it was, as soon as I saw it, I fell in love with this place. It was an abandoned monastery. And I asked, why aren't there any monks here? And they said, because it's too quiet for them. That's what they said. And it really was quiet. There was a traffic problem. And the traffic problem was, you only saw one car once a week, if you happened to be looking in the right direction. Once a week it would come up to take any mail or any stuff up to the village, and it would take any produce or people who wanted to get and lift down the mountain back again. right on the borders, you know, between Thailand and Burma. So, and it was quiet. The villagers only wanted to feed me. They didn't really want to listen to any Dhamma. And that really suited me. But the best part of it, it was high up in the mountains, and it was in the middle of a tea plantation. And for an English monk, you can't get better than this. As much tea was all around you, whatever you wanted, it was there for you. And also, there's a nice cave in there, which I spent a lot of lovely time in. To this day, that cave had lots of bats in it. But I had such nice meditation in that cave, that to this day, whenever I smell bat poo, it brings back happy memories. So it's one of my favorite smells, bat poo. It's true. Because it's the associations you have. That what makes it. The other favorite smell I have just shows how conditioning works. The other favorite smell I have is of like tar. And I always wonder, why did that smell of tar make me feel comfortable? And it was because, you know, after the Second World War, all the metal was melted down to make bombs and stuff. So around the parks and recreation fields, they had to replace all of the metal railings with wooden ones. And the only way they could maintain those wooden ones was every year to paint it with tar. And so I spent so many wonderful days, months of my life playing soccer in the park. I got used to that smell of tar, and it sort of is associated with happy memories from my past. So those are the two smells which I like. So let's see some bat poo. Brings back happy memories. But anyway, where was I going with this one? In this monastery up in the mountains. By myself, perfect conditions. Not too hot, not too cold. And I was by myself, it's my 6th year as a monk, and I was meditating. First of all, it went really well, enjoying the peace and the solitude all day, do whatever I want. But then, towards about a month, maybe 5 weeks into the rains retreat, I started getting restless. I started thinking. And you know what I did? I tried to stop the thoughts using my willpower. So I sat there and said, I'm going to watch my breath. Really watch. And as soon as I tried to watch my breath, these thoughts would come in. And the problem was, they got worse and worse. And worse, stronger and more uncontrollable. And soon those thoughts became what the only word I can call is unmonkish thoughts. It was the thoughts about old girlfriends, wondering, is she available still? I'm only 28, 29, still strong, still fit, still, actually that was a myth. I was really thin and skinny by that time. So, I want to be a monk. I love being a monk. I don't want to sort of disrobe. So I said, okay, come watch the breath. And then the thoughts would come in again. And every time I tried to stop those thoughts, they got worse. And I started going crazy almost. There's so many thoughts, fantasies, weird stuff. And I'm a monk. I don't want this. And every time that happened, it got worse. And I didn't have anybody to talk to. There was, you know, no other monks I could contact, and no telephone or anything. So one day, I got so frustrated and so exhausted. I went down, I bowed to the Buddha statue, and I just basically asked for help. And an insight came up. It wasn't really an insight, it was just a crazy idea. And a crazy idea was to do a deal. And the deal was that I would behave for most of the day. For 1 hour every afternoon, from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m, anything goes. I wouldn't try and control my mind. Any weirdest sexual fantasies, stuff I'd be embarrassed to even sort of talk about to, to my friends, let alone to you guys. I said to a therapist, let alone to ordinary people. And I said, no. I said, that time, 3 to 4, anything goes. And I thought that was a fair deal. But it didn't work the way I expected. It did actually work. It taught me a lot. But not the way I expected, because the day was just as difficult as it was before my deal. Still, I tried to watch my breath, and still the thoughts would batter all of my defenses down, and they'd come and obsess me. And I'd get embarrassed with hiri-otapa, that's the shame and fear of just consequences, and I'd just go on to the breathing again and try loving-kindness and try everything, and nothing worked until it got to 3 p.m. So, okay, I'm going to keep my part of the bargain. It's why that, you know, I was taught by Ajahn Chah always to be honest. If you promise something, you have to keep it. Which is one of the reasons why, when people invite me to go here and invite me to go there and invite me, can you please come and teach somewhere here, somewhere there? You notice I never say yes. I say I'll think about it. Because thinking about it is code for no, I don't want to go. Because if you say, can you please come to the house and give some blessings? And if I say no, you keep pestering me. Come on, it's important. You say no. I say, no, but no, we need to see you. No, 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 no. Until when I say yes, then that's the only way to keep you quiet. But then, instead, I become more diplomatic. You say, can you please come? I say, oh, yeah, I'll think about it. And that's not lying. Even though I've been thinking about some invitations for about 10, 15 years now. But anyhow, so, 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. went to my hut and said, okay, anything goes. Literally anything. I'm not going to stop anything. I'm not going to be embarrassed. I'm not going to shut crazy, silly, stupid, sexy thoughts down. 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. anything goes. It was an amazing experience, because then it just really sort of shook me that for the next hour from 3 to 4 p.m. I was able to watch every breath without missing one. So easy. And that was counterintuitive. How come when I was trying so hard to be a good monk, I was going crazy? But when I let go, I said, okay, whatever, then I was peaceful. Weird, isn't it? But that is the nature of our mind. The anger-eating demon feeds off negativity. Just trying to do something, trying to be somewhere, trying to go somewhere, of course it tires you and it makes you stressed. But when you really let go, it's amazing what happens. If you let go properly, full on, make peace, the mind's at peace. It doesn't want to go anywhere. So these are great insights. And I've mentioned before that why was it so difficult to watch a breath? You know, you can watch a breath for maybe 3 minutes or 3 breaths or something. Well, why not 3,000? And it is because we don't know how to be with things. Don't know how to let them be and be friends with them and allow them to be with us. So we don't go and grab them and put them in a prison. Often give a simile of a bird in a cage. If you keep a bird in a cage, then one day you will leave that cage door open and it will fly away and never come back. It's free. But if you make that cage comfortable, nice food, nice bed, air conditioning, whatever, then, yeah, that bird might fly away, but it'll always come back again. Simply because it's a nice, wonderful cage. And it's free. It can leave, but it likes to stay because it's comfortable, well cared for, and friendly. And of course, you know what I'm talking about. That cage is your mind, is your, what you put around your mind. You can't do this and you can't do that, you have to stay with your breath. But if you let that cage door open, your mind flies away, fantasizes, thinks, goes to sleep, it doesn't want to come back. But if you make your mind a very kind, a very peaceful, very forgiving place, of course it will come back. Because it's a wonderful place to stay. So it's the wisdom which taught me insights about the power of kindness. Kindness to your body, kindness to your mind. And don't be so controlling and fault-finding, otherwise your mind will go all over the place and be so hard to bring back. So one of the reasons why that whenever I do see my mind getting stuck somewhere, usually the first antidote is kindness. Okay, mind, I can understand you're tired, you're working hard. I can understand, so just relax, mind. We know as Buddhists it's wonderful because we now have many, many births. So you don't have to get enlightened this lifetime. It's not just a life and life or death achievement. So just relax. When it happens, it happens. You know, you've got other retreats to come to. So that, you know, none of you are going to die yet. So just relax. There's another retreat coming soon. So you never have to think, oh my goodness, only 2 or 3 days to go, I have to give everything I've got, I don't know when I can come on a retreat again. Just relax to the max. And just enjoy this moment. And don't just go putting all your effort into trying to get enlightened today. Or tomorrow, or the day afterwards, especially when you don't really know what enlightenment is. Just like there are many people these days who didn't have, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't wait until you put your, should I start all over again? No, don't worry about it. It's all the same old stories as many people know. But, so that when we learn how the wonderful thing about kindness, at all stages of our meditation, it makes meditation so easy. Second factor of the Eightfold Path, the importance of letting go. It's called nekama, renouncing. It doesn't mean renouncing that just shaving off your hair and becoming a monk or a nun. Yeah, that's part of renouncing. But always just letting go of all your wanting and craving and desires and even your spiritual desires of wanting to become enlightened, wanting to become peace, wanting to do this, wanting to get another jhana, wanting to get psychic powers, wanting, wanting, wanting. It's the wanting, and the antidote to that wanting is just letting things be. Being happy to be here. This is good enough. Just this. This moment has come. It's teaching me something. Old Emperor's Three Questions meditation, now most important time. All you're experiencing right now is the most important. And the most important thing to do is just care. Care for, open the door of your heart to this moment, let it be. You become really still. That's the only way you can be still, with caring for this moment. And anyway, once you start caring for this moment, instead of fighting all your fantasies and fears, just care, and they're teaching you something. When you understand what they're teaching you, and the antidote to them, then you find out that they don't affect you anymore. Little by little, you become peaceful. And as you become peaceful, that's when the wisdom comes to you. Don't ever chase wisdom. What are some nice little stories? First of all, the story of the little novice in Wat Pa Pong many years ago. And he was listening to a talk by Ajahn Chah in the evening. And some of Ajahn Chah's talks, what you see written in books, what you have translated into many languages is just like people who mine gold or diamonds. They take off all the diamonds and the gold, and all the rest they sort of put somewhere else. And that's what happens with Ajahn Chah. So I was there. Sometimes he talked for hours and hours and hours. And some of it was really boring. It was rubbish. And I say that because I really admire and respect my teacher. But every night it was worthwhile going through, because every now and again he'd say something which was really, wow, that was really worth keeping. But a lot of the time, you had to wait for that, hour after hour. And sometimes you'd go on for a long time, 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours. And then, sort of, it was okay for monks. We were the tough guys. We also had these little novices, 11, 12 years of age. And so one of these little novices was sitting there because he had to. He didn't want to be there at all. He was getting tired. Started thinking, it's okay for these big monks, but not me. I'm a little fellow. I need to go to bed. I need my sleep. And so he was really getting very restless and negative. When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? I know that because sometimes I thought the same. When is he going to stop? So much so, you know, we have these bells. I started, you know, sort of wondering how I can get out of this. And so they had the bell. You had to wait until Ajahn Chah rang the bell. So what I decided to do, I thought my plan was to get one of these little slingshots, you know, with a rubber band. And I'd practice in the forest so no one could see me. And so I was really quick and accurate. And when Ajahn Chah had his eyes closed with everybody else, I get out my slingshot and bing! So you wouldn't know, you know, who did that? But by the time he'd looked around, all the monks had bowed and gone out. That's what I thought. I never had the guts to do it. Because sometimes Ajahn Chah had psychic powers, he'd probably know straight away who was responsible. But anyway, that's what it was like sometimes. You got sort of bored by all this long talks and stuff. So anyway, so this little novice, he told us afterwards, he was sitting there and thinking, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When's he going to stop? When's he going to stop? And it became like this loop of thinking, when's he going to stop? When's he going to stop? This is a great example of what insight is. When's he going to stop? And then this little novice, only 10 or 11 years of age, he had an insight, which is seeing things the other way around. And his insight was, when am I going to stop? And that's what the little novice said, when am I going to stop? And he stopped. He really stopped. Another word for letting go, stop. And when he stopped, he really stopped. When he opened his eyes, it was the morning time. He had a beautiful, blissful meditation. And he opened his eyes, all the monks had gone on arms round. He didn't mind. And importantly also, they'd all bowed, done the chanting at the end of the talk, bowed and just put all their things together and went out the hall. So he wasn't quiet and silent, but he hadn't heard any of this. The different officers sat for hours and hours because he'd stopped. Stop complaining, stop wanting, stop striving, stop doing. Stop. I always remember that. Remember those of you who are knowledgeable about the Buddhist scriptures, about Angulimala? And what did the Buddha tell him? So whenever I go to crossroads in the great cities of the world, every time the car gets a red light, you always remember the Dhamma. Stop. So do you stop at the red lights? Your car might stop, but do you stop? No. Your mind carries on. When's it bloody light going to go green? I'm in a rush, isn't it? No, I've got an appointment. So, if we learn how to stop, that's a great way of letting go. Turning things around is insight. Just like, it's nice turning things around the other way around, and it brings a lot of understanding. Just like when I gave a talk once at a, at the Perth, at the old observatory over in Perth, next to the Parliament House now. I'm having something like the 100th anniversary or the 50th anniversary of the building of the old observatory, and just on the edge of King's Park. And so I was invited there to give the spiritual side. And there was also this Catholic astronomer there. And she said, you know, she was really honest. It's wonderful when people are just honest. She said, you know, my beliefs sometimes get threatened. You know, when sort of I look through the eyepiece of a telescope to the immense universe out there. And she said, that troubles me. And I told her not to worry when I gave my response. Because if any scientist looks at the big end of the telescope, looking back to find out who's doing the watching, then that challenges their beliefs in science. So it's turning the gaze, instead of going out into the universe is looking in to you. And that is freaky. Who's doing the watching? So she really liked that. She gave me a bottle of wine afterwards. And I said, oh, thank you, but no. But one of the other parts of that science, which relates back to meditation, instead of going somewhere, getting to the next attainment, getting to the next stage of meditation, how about stopping? Stopping where you are. Remember in meditation, stop. And see what happens. If you're not going this way or that way, there's only one other way to go. In. So, as well as that, there's this time of the meditation retreat, you know, it's only a few days to go, that people always get lost in this, well, you know, how's it going? What have I done so far? What do I still need to achieve? And it comes to all this measuring stuff. And this was when it turned the other way around. A little saying which somebody asked me, they knew I was a scientist, and our Buddhist. And they asked me about this Lord Kelvin, about measuring. Because Lord Kelvin, who was not only a physicist and an engineer, but also a philosopher, he was the first president of the Royal Society in London of Science, which is still one of the earliest and prestigious of intellectual groups. To get FRS after your name, Fellow of the Royal Society, is really, really hard and very prestigious. But anyway, this Lord Kelvin was once said, if we want to control nature, in other words, technology, we have to learn how to measure her accurately first. And that was an insight which gave birth to the Industrial Revolution, where first of all you had to have accurate measures. Just recently, the people in Monastery were showing me that the kilogram has been just adjusted by one fraction of a millionth of a percent or something, because they've got the standard kilogram in France somewhere in some vault, because they don't want anyone to mess around with it. And standard seconds and standard meters. So we have an accurate measurement of things. And once we have accurate measurement, then we can control this world with technology. But then, it's great to turn things upside down. What happens if you don't measure? If you don't measure the progress in your meditation? If you don't even measure how peaceful, how agitated your mind is, and don't pick fault with me. But you told me about a piezometer, you've got to measure it. It's only just to get you to understand what a piezometer is and what the piece is. But suppose you never measured anything in your body or in your mind. That would mean you can't control things. Which means you just have to let things be. You have no choice. Will is a form of control, the underlying controlling agency. And if you don't measure anything, what can you do? Nothing. And interestingly, the word for measuring in Pali is called manati. Just a new novice monk is apamana, is beyond measure, measureless. And that comes from the word for mind, mano. In Pali, it's just what the mind does. It measures things, assesses them, and then the will comes in and controls it and causes all the activity. So imagine, just imagine, you stop measuring things. If you didn't measure things, you have nothing to achieve. There is no fault. Because when we measure ourselves, we measure other people. That's when we have the good, the bad, and the ugly. Now that was a movie a long time ago. We can't assist. And measurement always gets us in trouble. Doesn't matter how highly you measure up, you've got more to do. That was just really, and even if you become enlightened, well, there's always psychic powers to do next. So, have you reached all your goals yet? What are goals anyway? Just measurements. There was a monk who went to see the Buddha. Ananda was sitting next to the Buddha. And the monk said, one who is fully enlightened never thinks they are better than anybody else, never thinks they're worse than anyone else, never thinks they're the same as anyone else. I said, oh yeah, very good, excellent, yes, well done. And then another monk came up to the Buddha and said, almost exactly the same. One who's an arahat, got rid of all the defilements, all the attachments, everything. Never thinks better than others, or worse than others, or the same. Yes. And then the Buddha turned around to Ananda and said, those are two of my disciples who've recently become arahats. That's how they tell. Their teacher. They've stopped measuring. They're not better, they're not worse, they're not the same. Gives you an idea. If anyone comes along and says, I'm an arahat, of course you ain't. If anyone thinks you're better than anyone else, of course you're not. If anyone thinks they're worse than the other people, of course you're not. If anyone thinks they're all the same, no. That's another form of measuring. So when we stop measuring, all those things disappear. And I know that people ask me, can you please tell us a story of when you became enlightened? It's one of the questions down here. There's another question down here. I don't understand this one. A survey, please. Please participate. Have you ever seen a cockroach in England? Yes, no. Your participation is well appreciated. I don't know if that's a joke or not. Or is that something serious? Have you ever seen a cockroach in England? Yeah, I don't know if you ever asked me if you've ever seen a tiger in the wild. Once I came face to face with a tiger. A big one. Huge. And It was only a few feet away from me. An amazing thing is, you know, sometimes you can't predict if a person's going to be afraid or going to be sort of peaceful. And this time, this huge tiger just staring at me, I wasn't afraid at all. I wasn't scared. Totally peaceful and fascinated by this immense, beautiful beast. Do you think that was really amazing? Many of you have heard the story before. That was when I was visiting a zoo. There's big bars in front. So anyway, seen a cockroach in England? I'm sure I have. That's a long time ago. So I don't know actually the purpose of that question. Anyway, why should questions have a purpose? Anyway, if I mess up that question. Anyway, when I became enlightened. So this was again in one of the forest monasteries in Thailand. And that it's actually the year before I was off in the jungles, you know, in the north of Thailand. Where I had the cave and those stupid thoughts. But anyway, there I was meditating. Very simple, lots of energy, meditating, walking and sitting, walking and sitting. And of course, it started to build up. Just when you have a long retreat, the energy, the peace, the insights get stronger and stronger. And the mind becomes brighter and brighter. And some days you get such wonderful meditation that you cannot even go to sleep at night. You've got too much energy, and it's beautiful energy. Why waste that? You can always go to sleep during the talk. But, no, don't do that. So, getting lots of energy, getting really happy and clear and blissful. And it's actually really interesting when I was doing the walking meditation, because the sitting gave you the clarity, the energy, you're walking backwards and forwards, you know, so focused, easy mindfulness, powerful mindfulness, everything was really beautiful. And all, of course, is all these insights started coming into you, started understanding things. All these things your teachers have been talking about, which you never really got. The understanding, just the nature of your body and your mind, and they kept coming in. Every time you get an insight, it's just like a big blockage, a big burden had fallen off you, and you felt so lighter and more free, more happy, more energized. Mindfulness getting stronger, more and more insights coming up, and just then the big one came. Bigger than any other insights I'd ever seen. Everything became so clear. And it was so wonderful. Another arahat had appeared in the world who could take the real teachings back to maybe to England to help my family and those poor deprived Poms in that little island. And I thought, wow, this is really cool, this is really good. So much energy, so much joy. And it was really lots of energy. I kept on walking, and I thought I should really sit down. It was getting about to 2 o'clock in the morning. I'd rather just lay down. I lay down for about 15 minutes, but no sleep. There's bliss going through your body, all over, energized. No way you wanted to sleep. So then up into the hall before 3 o'clock, because they used to have to meet at 3 o'clock, and heard the bell ring in the morning at 3 a.m. as I was sitting in the hall really early. And as the bell would ring, usually it's bell, isn't it? I need my sleep, but not this morning. Wonderful, the sonorous sound of the bell was just so amazing. And the mosquitoes who would come about that time, take your fill. I give everything to the mozzies. And when we did the chanting, now sometimes, you know, do real chanting, yo, sa, or sa, this was even more powerful than that. Just blasting with some of the energy and meditating, and wow, no sleepiness at all. And then came the arms round, as we were walking on arms round, and every time one of these lucky villagers put a piece of sticky rice into my bowl, you don't know just how lucky you are to have given dana to a newly minted arahat. And I zap them with loving kindness, powerful. Oh, it's just a wonderful feeling being an arahat for the first time. And and then when we came back to the dining room over in this little forest monastery, just full of joy and happiness and loving kindness, just flooding out of me, like oozing out of every pore to every living being there. And then I saw there was something different. Usually every day we had the same meal. Sticky rice and rotten fish curry. You know, there's no vegetarian food there at all. Rotten fish curry, because subsistence, really poor indigenous culture. And in that rotten fish, they would catch the fish in the previous rains. Tiny little fish. Put them in a jar, a piece of plastic over the top, and let them rot. And when they became like game, like stinky and smelly, that's what they really liked. Stinky fish. Plade. And so every day we had the same. And you got used to it, but it really stank. And what was that story, just to give you an idea what it was like? I was cleaning around the kitchen, I saw one of the jars. It was only like a piece of plastic with a rubber band. The rubber band or the plastic had broken. The flies had got in and laid their eggs, and so it was crawling with maggots. So I saw it, I thought, I'm just going to throw this away. And the head man of that village came up and said, what are you doing? I said, look, you know, it's been spoiled, it's got sort of maggots in it. He said, no, extra protein. And that's what we had the next day. Yeah, yuck. But it's every day, you got used to it. But that day, there was another pot of curry. And I think it was a pork-based curry or something. But it was actually just, you know, the sort of stuff you get in the city, not in the forest. And I thought straight away, ah, yeah. The heavenly beings, the devas, have recognized this a new enlightened being in this forest. So they too want to make some good karma. To celebrate, you know, you have a birthday, you have special food, or, you know, an occasion, you have a cake or something. I said, wow. The heavenly beings have figured it out, and they also want to get a bit of the action, a bit of the extra good karma today. It's also actually quite liked it, you know, because I was fed up with the rotten fish curry, day after day after day. Even one day is enough, let alone all for 3 months. So I thought, ah, yes, celebration day. And what happened next is, you know, there's hardly anybody in the monk's monastery, so the head monk over there, he took his first of all, and his big ladles, and about 3 or 4 of them. No way in the world could people eat so much of that, you know, that city curry. And straight away I thought, greedy pig. But then, I thought, that doesn't matter, there's plenty left. But what he did next was just totally beyond any reasonable person would do, let alone a monk. A senior monk at that. Because he was born in that village, and so he was used to the rotten fish curry. He took the big saucepan of rotten fish curry, which he had just, no, of pork curry, which he'd already just taken his own. He hadn't taken any rotten fish yet. And he poured them into one. And he got the ladle and stirred it around and said, it's all the same. Mern gan lai, all the same. And I thought, if it was all the same, why did you take yours first? you know, just the one fish cut, the pork curry, and you left me this mixed up curry. You're a hypocrite, that's what you are. And that's when it really hit me. Arahats, enlightened beings, don't really worry about what they eat. Certainly they don't get angry at their abbot. And you know that all that wonderful feeling of being enlightened, the great joy and peace and bliss, it all disappeared, and I realized what depression really is. Losing your fortune, losing your home, losing your marriage, it's nothing like losing your enlightenment. Oh no. And I didn't care what I ate then. Just bunged it in and just passed it down. That really, really spoils your day. When you think you're alive, you find out you weren't. But it just showed me just how you've got to be really careful, you know, of all this attainment business. So easy to convince yourself, yay, I'm enlightened now, yay, I'm enlightened now. And then something happens and, oh no, I'm not. So that's one of the reasons why the whole idea of attainment is all ego, sense of self. So it's one of the reasons why these attainments, the inside is not getting anywhere. Learning how to disappear. Learning how to let go. Learning how to vanish. More and more places where you can't find a self. Until, if you need to put a medal on somebody, you need something to put the medal on. Imagine pinning a medal to the air, putting a certificate just onto the sky. There's nowhere to hang it. It vanishes and disappears. Nothing to hang anything on. Now let's get more into it. And just to finish off this wonderful little story, which I told from a Sri Lankan gentleman concerning a meditation center over in Colombo many years ago. It's closed down now. And now you find out why it was closed down. Because there was this old grandma from up country Sri Lanka, visiting her children in Colombo. And the children thought, what can we do to look after our grandma? She's such a nice, wonderful person. But you know, what does she need? What does she want? And they realized that she always went to the temple on these Poya days and, you know, the moon days. And they thought, well, you know, just, she goes there, she lights the incense, she keeps the precepts, she gives food to the monks, but there's more to it than that. So they knew about this meditation center, this retreat center, just outside of Colombo, run by these lay teachers. And at these retreats, not just meditation, but study. And at the end of the retreat, about, you know, 2 months or something, they would give you an exam, a test, to find out how far you've gone in both meditation and your experiences and also your understanding of the Dhamma. And if you did very well, then they would talk about your case and assess how far you've gone. And if you've gone far, they would even give a certificate to you. And this old lady, she went on that retreat for 2 months, happy just to practice the Dhamma. And at the end of the course, the teachers came up to her and said, you know, Auntie, you've done very, very well. We've assessed your meditation, your experiences, and your knowledge of the teachings, and we're very pleased to say that you are a stream winner. In Sri Lanka, it's called a Sowan. and we're here to give you the certificate. You're a soul one. Congratulations, Auntie. First stage of enlightenment. And she looked at them and got really angry. Really upset. And they said, why, Auntie? It's a wonderful attainment. A stream winner. You're not going to get reborn in the lower realms anymore. Only 6 more lifetimes at most. Destined to Nibbana. It's a fantastic achievement. Why are you angry? And then she looked at them. She said, you don't remember me, do you? No. I was here about 3 years ago. And you said I was a non-returner. And I've still got the certificate. You've demoted me. That's why these certificates are just not worth the paper they're written on. So, because of that, don't go around measuring yourself. Let yourself disappear so there's nothing to measure. Then we can have some understanding, some wisdom about letting go. Imagine, nothing to do. There's no one to do it. You've cut your hand off. You can't pick up anything. There's no stick by which they can measure you. You're gone. You've gone, baby. You've gone. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Please forgive me for saying that phrase. You're gone, baby, you've gone. But I always get a little laugh. Okay, very good. So now we do have some interviews. For those who put the name down, and for those who haven't put the name down, it's time to interview the Devas.